Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Thank you for sticking with us for this past decade or so. Today, our guest is Heather Clark, author of Red Comet, The Short Life and Blazing Art of Sylvia Plath, published by Knopf just about a year ago. And it's available in paperback now, and you can come by Wellington Square Bookshop. It's on the front table. Heather is also the author of The Grief of Influence, Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, as well as The Ulster Renaissance, Poetry in Belfast, 1962 to 1972. Her work has appeared in the Harvard Review, the Times Literary Supplement, one of my favorites, as well as many other periodicals. And Red Comet was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in biography this year. Heather was also a scholar consultant for the BBC documentary Sylvia Plath, Life Inside the Bell Jar, which I would highly recommend as well. She's professor of contemporary poetry at the University of Huddersfield. So Red Comet explores quite comprehensively the life and times of a name that we all know as a name. And that's about it for most Americans. Yeah. Some know the bell jar, especially young people who may feel from time to time, as Sylvia did in her early years. They come into our bookstore, they buy the book. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she felt that way through much of her life. And as Heather informs us, and this is one of the things we don't know, the lives of her ancestors and her progeny. And then there is Ted Hughes and the climactic suicide and the gas and the oven, which is the story those who know more know. And those who take a stance may consider Hughes a demon, a thief, a gaslighter, a purloiner. And I could go on since I am one of those. But what Sylvia's life really is poetry. And as Ted Hughes said, she's not a writer of poems, she's a poet. The Bell Jar, Colossus, Ariel, her collected poems, most published posthumously. And she also was the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Yeah. But all this stuff, she never saw this legendary status that she reached. And many of the poems that we may discuss today were written just before her death, many jumbled a bit by the executor of her estate, her husband, who also burned many of her diaries for reasons that many suspect but don't know. And I do Heather an injustice by talking so much about those events that make up her life for most people, because this book is so much more and tells us so much more about this Sylvia Plath, not the legend, but the person, her love of Beethoven, her relationship with her parents, her letters, her doubts, her relationships with others, and her poetry. So with that, welcome, Heather, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, I could begin like people begin with Ted and suicide, but instead of that, let's talk a little bit about what we're really talking about, which is poetry, and that made up a life, sometimes poems a day, whether it's Ariel or Colossus, or poems like, oh, this is, we can do this, Stings, which is one of your epigraphs, mm-hmm. and the source of the title of this book. So actually, do you have it? Oh, show up the cover of your book.
Yeah, sure. Let me see. The cover, here is the cover of the hard copy right there. Yep.
Yeah, I always love that picture.
There's a nice photo on the spine as well of Sylvia Plath in Paris. Yeah.
I like the way people always talk about her looking like kind of like a Doris Day figure.
No, she's actually in this photograph, they blew it up, but she's looking at Ted Hughes. But I really like the way that they managed to get her whole face on the cover. And I liked the fact that she was smiling, because I did go through a few different covers and she looked, on some of the covers, she looked quite morose. And I wanted her to appear energetic, I suppose, on the cover, if not happy, but.
Yeah, and it's funny, it just goes to show you how you really don't know what's going on in someone's head. None of us can ever know that. And in many pictures, I actually think she does look happy and comfortable and well-dressed and social, which she was.
Yeah, she was extremely social. And I think we all, like you were saying, we have this cliche in our mind of Sylvia Plath, the depressed poet, right? And people, when I would tell people that I was writing a biography of Sylvia Plath, usually the first thing that they would bring up was her suicide, right? And it seemed like she was better known for the manner in which she died than she was for her writing. And through the years, that had really bothered me because I'm a college professor and I had taught lots of classes on Sylvia Plath. And it bothered me so much that I decided that I would try to write a new biography of Sylvia Plath that tried to refocus our attention on the writing and on her literary ambitions and literary life, you know, rather her commitment to art, as I put it, rather than to death. I think I say something like that in the prologue.
Yeah, although, you know, I think it's good. You didn't ignore it either.
No.
And you kind of got it out of the way at the beginning, you know, which was good.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that was one of the real challenges of writing this book for me was, you know, I didn't want to put her suicide and her depression and her struggles with mental illness, I didn't want to make that front and center. And I didn't want that to be the whole story of the life. At the same time, she is someone who struggled with severe depression. She is someone who died by suicide. And I didn't want to ignore that or whitewash that, but, you know, I just didn't want that to be it, right? That to be the whole story.
Well, then why, here's a question, why kind of as a gnomon or like the outside of a jigsaw puzzle box, why did you choose Stings as your epigraph? Because the idea of Red Comet and judging a book by its cover, which every one of my bookstore does, you know, right. It's like Red Comet, it could be a science fiction book. And just the idea of that poem, you know, gives you this idea of this streak across the sky that's not going to be with us forever, but as it comes across the sky, which is not necessarily what she meant. But why did you choose it? And why did you choose that as a title?
I will just read the stanza. It comes from, it's right in the beginning of the book. I wasn't sure that people would automatically know the poem Stings and that, you know, Red Comet was actually referring to Plath's own words. So we put it in the beginning of the book. And I'll just read a couple stanzas from Stings. They thought death was worth it, but I have a self to recover, a queen. Is she dead? Is she sleeping? Where has she been with her lion red body, her wings of glass? Now she is flying, more terrible than she ever was. Red scar in the sky, red comet, over the engine that killed her, the mausoleum, the wax house. So yes, that idea, the idea of the red comet, it sort of dovetailed nicely with another idea in that poem about recovering herself. I have a self to recover, a queen. And I sort of felt like in my book, I was trying to recover a different side of Sylvia Plath that had been lost in the mythology. And in fact, my first title, I think, was Recovering Sylvia Plath. I think that was my, you know, in my book proposal. And the title went through a few different iterations, and I have to give credit to my editor who actually came up with the final title. She wanted something short and bold, and my titles had been sort of longer and I think more academic. So,
well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, there is the suicide, it's there. And then you look at a poem like that, and you know that death is intimately involved. And then you bookend, no pun intended, that with Edge, which is a poem she wrote like 6 days before she died. Yeah. And it does echo to a certain extent, kind of echo to a certain extent, Stings, in the sense that you have this woman who's perfected herself by completing the act that's described to a certain extent in the Stings, you know. And she's writing this 6 days before, and you know, at least you think that all this must be in her mind, especially when she uses all those white type terms like bones and milk and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. And the moon is my mother. She is not sweet like Mary. And yeah, I mean, I think those poems, especially the a poem like Edge, which I think is probably the last poem she wrote. It's often, I've read it interpreted as a suicide note. I mean, people often read it, interpret it as an actual suicide note. And in my book, I point out that yes, it is a disturbing poem. It's a poem about a dead woman lying with her two children and in this sort of spectral tableau. But the poem itself is very elusive. Like Plath draws on Shakespeare. She draws on D.H. Lawrence, Sarah Teasdale, W.B. Yeats, the art of Giorgio de Chirico. Like it's almost this collage of other poets and artists. And so, you know, it's confessional in one sense, right? In that Plath did but die by suicide. And it is hard to read that poem without thinking about Plath's life. But I wanted to show people that there's also a real artfulness about that poem, right? And it's something that was crafted, and she thought about the meter and the rhyme and the form of the poem. And it's still a work of art, right? It's not just sort of this impulsive memoiristic piece. So I think even at the end, the craft was still so important to her. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because before I get to the next issue I have with that poem, it's like all what you're saying about all the other poets that she relies on, she might expect the reader to know all that like she did in college.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't know what she was talking about, fellow students. So yeah, it's all there. When you read analysis and interpretation, yeah, they go to that. But yeah, the general reader is going to say, I don't know that. And
yeah, and that was another side of Sylvia Plath that I wanted to emphasize, was just how brilliant she was, you know, as a student, as a critic. We all know that she was a very talented poet, but she graduated summa cum laude from Smith College with a degree in English, even after attempting suicide and spending a few months at McLean Hospital. You know, she still managed to graduate summa cum laude. And she knew every literary reference in every novel. You know, she just was one of those brilliant, brilliant people who, yeah, I mean, she was always the smartest person in the room.
Yeah, it's like it's difficult to graduate summa cum laude when you're minoring in suicide.
Yeah, it's the things that she had to overcome to achieve what she did. It's really incredible. And so I, again, you know, we have this idea of Sylvia Plath as maybe fragile or passive, and I found a poet who was quite strong and determined and willful and stubborn. And so I was always sort of surprised by her strength and determination to become a great poet, which was really her life's vocation, and just trying to overcome obstacle after obstacle. And remember, she's a woman in the 1950s who wants to be a great writer. And that's not so easy at that time, especially if you're struggling with mental health.
Yeah. And you use the word confessional, and in any biography or analysis or Wikipedia entry, you're going to see that she's like the founder of some confessional movement. But I find, like with Edge, okay, yeah, as you said, it's confessional, but yeah, it almost seems a little triumphant in a sense. You know, yeah, I finally, yeah, you know, she's perfected. I finally reached the goal that I've been striving for all my life. Maybe that's a little too morbid, but it's there, right?
The woman is perfected. Yeah, that's how the poem begins. But I sort of read that as an ironic statement about, you know, a dead woman is the perfect woman because she can't talk back. She's silent. She's perfect in her beauty. And I think she's hearkening back to a Yeats poem called He Wishes His Beloved Were Dead, because Sylvia Plath loved Yeats. And so I think she's having a conversation actually with Yeats in that poem. And maybe it's also a conversation with Ted Hughes. And yeah, it's a very complicated poem.
Even just the idea of the bare feet, you know, it's like, have I walked as far as I can possibly walk? Is, you know, I'm just tired out, you know. It's got, that's the thing. Even the shortest poems have so much, they're like portmanteau words, you know, they have all this stuff stuffed in it. But you have to be pretty smart to know that. And I'm not, but
yeah. And, you know, she's somebody who poetic form was always really important to her from the time she was a child to her last poem, you know, when she was 30. She was always someone who cared about a poem. I mean, she was almost a traditionalist in that sense, a poem sounding like a poem. She wasn't writing chopped prose, if you know what I mean. Everything, the sounds had to gel together, the meter had to work, the stanza lengths are usually quite standard. So yeah, she was conservative in that way. I wouldn't say she was conservative about her subject matter, but in her poetic form, yeah, she still adhered to some traditional ideas.
I like at the beginning how you were just talking about it being a suicide note. I like in the beginning how, it's hard to say like, but I like in the beginning how you say the suicide note really is just call the doctor, you know.
And right, I mean that's what it is. Please call Dr. Horder. And that word please guts me, right? Something about, yeah, just the,
she wasn't normal, she would not normally use that word.
It's just the decorousness of beginning a suicide note, please call a doctor. And that you're thinking, almost thinking about manners, and something about it really, really got to me. Yeah.
You know, another thing too is like with Ariel, you know, she didn't see it. She almost didn't see the bell. And the other thing is like, you know, I was born in 52. So I was aware of the Cuban Missile. I was ducking under my desk for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And my parent, you know, I'm Jewish. So, you know, I was constantly thinking about, you know, I had relatives, you know, and I always forget that she died the same year that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. It's hard to place her in time, but some of the things you read actually indicate, and I don't know whether you believe this or not, that she might, I don't feel her being affected by her times. And I don't know whether she was or not.
Like, yeah, I think she was. And I think that we often think of her as quite an apolitical writer, and more of, you know, that word confessionalism comes up again. And some critics have even accused her of being like this narcissistic navel gazer who's only interested in herself, right? In her interiority, in her own personal crises. But, you know, I read a book like The Bell Jar, which starts off with a sentence about the execution of the Rosenbergs. And I read that novel as a very political novel about Cold War America, about the repressions of the Eisenhower era, especially when it came to women. And Plath died a week before Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique was published. So she missed the women's movement. She did not live through the women's movement, but a lot of her poems are, you know, people might call them proto-feminist. But yeah, I think a novel like The Bell Jar is, I think the politics of that novel are sort of hiding in plain sight. And Plath really makes this quite clear equivalence in that novel between the execution of the Rosenbergs. They're electrocuted, right? They go to the electric chair for espionage. They're accused of selling atomic secrets to the Soviets. And then later in that novel, the heroine, Esther Greenwood, has electroshock therapy, right? And Plath is really making a kind of case there for this idea of dissidents almost, you know, being punished by electric shock. So I think she's doing some really interesting things, especially in that novel. And, you know, some of her most famous poems were written the week of the Cuban Missile Crisis, October of 1962. Mm. And critics have gone, you know, literary critics have gone back and kind of picked apart, you know, pieces of the poem that might have to do with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I'm pretty convinced by that it's there, you know.
And yeah, critic, as you say, pick apart everything, yeah. And then you know, there's this argument. Okay, was she a feminist? Was she not a feminist? And I'm thinking to myself, I don't really care.
It's hard to sort of come down on it either way, because she died before second wave feminism became mainstream. So it's complicated, right?
Yeah, but it's like women, whether it's, say, Madeleine Albright, who doesn't really care. I mean, she's not talking about it. She just did what she did.
Right. Yep.
She never.
Yeah. I think, you know, so many, Plath herself was someone who had some opinions that we would think, wow, that's not really a feminist opinion, right? She tried to reassure her mother that she would never be a career woman, and, you know, don't worry about that. And she really, but she cared about women's equality. So I think when the women's movement came into its own in the 70s, they really grasped onto a lot of Plath's poems as almost like sort of anthems, if you know, of the women's movement. A poem like Daddy, especially, Daddy, Daddy, you bastard, I'm through. That's how the poem ends. So I think she was such an important poet for later generations of feminists, but at the time when she was writing these, you know, she had not been influenced by second wave feminism. So later generations sort of, you know,
all these things bring up other questions in my head. If I don't write them down, I'll forget them. But especially with Daddy and the fact that I feel bad for him because he was anti-Nazi as you could get. Yeah. And then the idea, I remember you talking about the idea that she liked the idea of juggling being a homemaker and a mother and a poet. She thought that was really cool.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some could say, oh, well, she's not a feminist. But I know I've said this, but it's not that important to me.
Right. Yeah.
But what I was going to say is I can't stay away from Ted Hughes. First of all, I hate his guts, and I always hate his guts, but, and the vandalizing of her grave and his grave, but I can't not talk about it because so much of what the poetry was and what her life was so affected by him and what I consider his abysmal behavior in so many different ways. But I don't want to go out. I don't want to go on and tell you what that behavior was. I guess I'd rather just ask you whether it's his affair or whether what he did after he became executor or his sister who was called her a bitch, but she was a bitch, you know, all that stuff mushed together. Tell us a little bit about that. Cause first, it happened. And second, people are really interested in it.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the reasons my book is so long is because of Ted Hughes. I mean, Ted Hughes was one of the major British poets of the post-war era. He and Plath were married for almost 7 years. So he actually takes up quite a bit of space in this book too. And at times it's almost like a double biography. I had written a previous book about Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath's influence on each other as poets. So and that fascinated me, that question of what did they learn from each other? How did they inspire each other, sort of thing. So I sort of came to that as an intellectual question. And I think, you know, the beginning of the marriage was really quite good, almost idyllic in many ways. And then things really devolved towards the end. In the beginning, you know, Plath was someone who had always wanted a man who would respect her poetic ambition and her talent and take her seriously as someone who really wanted to become a writer. And a lot of these guys she had dated at Smith did not take her seriously and did not respect her talent. And one of those men is satirized in The Bell Jar, Buddy Willard, who was based on a real boyfriend, Dick Norton. Anyway, so they had sort of treated her vocation condescendingly. And so when she met Ted Hughes, she felt like, okay, here's someone who wants me to write, who is supporting my ambition. And I think all of that is true. So the early years were very productive, and they both wrote a lot, and they both kind of took new turns in their writing. I think their writing benefited from being in that hothouse atmosphere. But toward the last couple of years, things really started to fall apart and got very bad. And yes, and Ted Hughes had an affair. He left Plath. He left for good around the time that she wrote Daddy in October of 1962. He left her for Assia Webble. And I think when he left her, that was actually quite good for her poetry in a sense, because she was just riding the waves of those of that fury and that heartbreak. And she wrote some of her best poems in the weeks right after Ted Hughes left. But then, she slowed down, and then she, a huge depression hit her in early 1963, kind of. It's like after the adrenaline rush, right, of writing some of the greatest poems of the 20th century. And then, a lot conspired, I think, those last couple months. It was not a good time for her.
And some of the things, some of this has become kind of mythology. And from what I know, I'm thinking, well, I think she helped him during the early years, much more than he helped her. But he kept harping after she died about how much he helped her. Even in that one letter where he goes, after she died, I wish I could have helped her like I helped her so many times before. Yeah. You have to put that in there. What kind of thing is that to put in the letter?
She did help him quite a bit. I don't even know that he would have become a recognized poet without her, right? Because she was his agent. She was sending out his manuscripts to everyone. She entered his book in the contest that he won, and that's how he got his first book published. So she was his secretary, she was his agent, she was his cheerleader, and she also ran the house and paid the bills and answered his letters. And she was in sheer sort of organizational terms, huge help to him.
He's poet laureate. Mm-hmm. Also kind of pisses me off. But I mean, what is there about him? Okay, that's what you wrote about. I mean, your other book. So what is there about him that you find, if you do, admirable, exciting, honest? And do you consider him like the greatest poet that England produced at that time?
I think he was quite important in the sense that he, in the mid-50s, he and his buddies at Cambridge, who we don't remember really now, but there were a group of poets at Cambridge, and they felt like modern British poetry had reached sort of a low point. They felt that it was just too safe, too traditional. The word genteel got thrown around a lot, and they wanted to breakthrough. They wanted to write a new kind of poetry that was bolder and more raw and more Yeatsian, more D.H. Lawrence. And so they were sort of like almost, like punk rock in a sense, of like the 1950s poetry scene. And when Plath met them, she was really inspired by that vision, because she felt the same way, like something was missing. And she kind of latched on to this group of, they called themselves rebel poets, actually. Somebody in the group used that phrase. She latched on to them and sort of felt like, okay, I'm gonna follow you guys. I'm gonna write like you write, because she recognized something in their published poems that she wanted in her own verse. And I don't mean to say that she just wrote like Ted Hughes. That's not what I'm saying. But I think that he almost gave her permission to just experiment and, with a different kind of voice. Because when she was a child, she had actually written these really stark and sometimes eerie poems. And, you read a poem that she wrote when she was 13, like A Winter Sunset, about this skeletal tree as the sun setting. And you think, like, that almost could have been an Ariel. So she had this voice, even as a child and adolescent, but it kind of got smoothed out at Smith. So when she meets Ted Hughes and his friends, I think that other voice kind of rears its head again. And so in terms of making her into the poet that she became, I don't know if she would have written Ariel if she had never met Ted Hughes. It was a really important turning point for her and for him too. Although I think meeting Robert Lowell was quite important, and Anne Sexton in America. because those two put, she was in Robert Lowell's creative writing class at Boston University in 1959, and Anne Sexton was in that class with her. So, you know, it was a similar kind of thing. They were opening up the poem. They were writing about mental illness and suicide attempts and being institutionalized at McLean and all of these things that Plath had actually experienced herself, but had been sort of, you know, didn't want to write about them in public, especially because it's the 50s and nice girls don't write about their suicide attempts in the 1950s. You know, that's just not, that was a very taboo subject then. And so I think from Anne Sexton and Robert Lowell, she learned that she could kind of probe those experiences in her poetry. So yeah, I think they were quite formative in terms of influences as well.
When you talk about, you know, the poems that she wrote when she was 13 and the same kind of feel that I think pervades everything, even like Ariel, you know, the word suicidal is pivotal in the poem. So talk a little bit about like this nature and nurture thing. And because no one knows really about her family, and you go into the history of her family three generations back. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and how her, you know, mother said there was this history of this type of feeling in the family. Because that's very interesting.
Yeah, there does seem to be a genetic issue. Sylvia Plath's maternal grandmother, we just learned, she was committed to an insane asylum in Oregon when she was older. And it could be that we don't really know if she was actually, you know, was she mentally ill? Was she coming? Did she have Alzheimer's? Was she just difficult? We don't know why, but her husband committed her to a mental hospital. And it's actually the mental hospital that where they filmed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So, which is, you know, just a kind of strange coincidence. But so she probably had some kind of mental illness. And then Plath's father, Otto, he died from complications of diabetes. But Sylvia Plath she sort of harbored this anger towards him because he was a fatalist. He didn't know that he had diabetes. He thought he had some terminal illness, like a terminal cancer. And he just decided that he wasn't going to go to the doctor and that if he died, you know, and it turned out that he could have been saved if he had gone to a doctor earlier, but because he had this really sort of fatalistic outlook, he died from diabetes. And so Plath felt like this sense of abandonment and why did you do this? And the sense of anger. And some of that I think does come out in a poem like Daddy. So who knows, there might've been some depression there as well. And then of course, Plath, the mental illness surfaces, I think when she's a teenager, she begins to what we would call manic depression, right? She is very elated, moods of elation, and then moods of, you know, depression and low moments. And it just seems to go up and down. And then when she's 19, she attempts suicide for the first time. She dies by suicide when she's 30 in February of 1963. And then tragically, her son also dies by suicide. I believe he was in his 40s. So I think it does seem like there's a genetic component.
Like the Hemingways.
Yeah.
But then, you know, those kinds of things, whether it's Franz Kafka or somewhat a gambler, like, you know, Dostoevsky it's like some Kafka writing Metamorphosis in one night because he was like completely depressed, and the best writing in the world comes out of that. You know, I feel bad for them, but at the same time, we wouldn't have it but for, right? We wouldn't have a lot of this but for.
Yeah, I mean, you do wonder about that. And I wonder about it with her Ariel poems, because she was sort of, she was up, riding these waves of creativity, especially after Ted Hughes left her. And she was almost determined to make a new life for herself. She was actually really excited about moving to London without him, and and meeting new people and holding literary salons. And all of her letters during that time are so exciting and full of hope and optimism and possibility. And she's writing and she's getting it all out. And then she crashes.
Right. I mean, in Ariel, she's writing in February, she's writing, you hand me two children.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think of the color of the poems from the autumn of 1962, when she's writing so many of her greatest poems, Burial, that color is red. I think of those poems as very hot poems and energetic poems full of movement. And then when she, you know, the new year comes along, she has a series of disappointments. The Bell Jar is rejected by American publishers, right? Which hit her really hard. The poems that follow are cool. They're blue. I think of them as blue toned poems. There's no movement. It's flat. It's resigned. You know, the tone is completely different in some of those poems that she wrote shortly before her death.
You know, it's not that it's narcissistic, but it's like the idea that she's kind of sending telegrams out to the world, you know, mm-hmm. saying this is what's going on now. It's almost like a letter to the world.
Yeah.
Yeah,
she wasn't that well known, you know, at the time. She was certainly not like that we know her as a, now she's so famous, but Ted Hughes was a much better known poet at the time.
Well, again, like Franz Kafka, I mean, if Max Brod hadn't broken his promise, we wouldn't have America, we wouldn't have the trial, we wouldn't have the castle. You know, I don't know if it's good to break a dying man's last request, but nonetheless.
Well, it's like Philip Roth, right? Didn't he tell his agents to burn all his,
Well, that goes to Ted Hughes, again, why I don't like him. It's because he burns all these journals, but, you know, these journals, when you do something like that, probably didn't say a lot of good stuff about him.
Yeah, I mean, there's speculation that they may still be around, because he wrote, there's a letter in his archive. He wrote to, I think it was the literary critic Jacqueline Rose, and said, actually, I didn't burn them, I saved them. So there is some speculation that they may exist somewhere. There's speculation that her novel, her unfinished novel, is still out there. Who knows? I wouldn't be surprised if this stuff surfaces someday.
Talk about double exposure. No one knows about that.
Yeah, well, she began this novel after Ted Hughes left her for Assia Webble, who was his lover in London. And it was sort of supposed to be a book about a woman whose husband had been unfaithful and a philanderer. I think she even used the word philanderer when she was talking about the novel to someone. And it was going to be about how she kind of just took control of her life, right? How she was able to move to London and raise her children by herself. And it was supposed to be this glorious like reawakening. and I think Ted Hughes probably would have come out of it very badly. So.
And the other thing is, I mean, if you have one wife who kills herself by putting her head in the gas oven, it's maybe coincidental, but if you have two, you know, it's hard to think of it as being coincidental. This is just me, because I'm so mad at him. I've always been so mad at him. But don't you think that's true? I mean, it's just
Assia Webble had attempted suicide many times before she met Ted Hughes. So I actually don't subscribe to the idea that, like, because of Ted Hughes, they both died by suicide. Because one of the things when I started this book was that I just felt like I couldn't put the blame on that for a person, whether it was a lot of people blame Aurelia Plath too, Sylvia's mother. And just from a philosophical standpoint, like I just said, nobody knows at the end of the day why someone dies by suicide. And I just felt like it wasn't my place in a sense. To judge.
Yeah, and that's when I say about all these bad things about Ted, it's not that I'm saying them as if they're true.
Yeah.
They're just things that I believe because of what I read. And that's why it's, that's the other thing the reviews talk about is, you obtained all the source material. How did you go about doing that? Like the police reports and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I just combed through all of the archives. I mean, I've spent years writing the book, so thousands and thousands of pages in archives and interviewing people who had known Plath, who had been friends with her, who were still alive, and who had documents, and they shared them with me. And so, yeah, I mean, but it was a long haul, let me tell you. And Ted Hughes's archives are relatively new in a sense. He died in 1998, and most of his archives were given to the British Library and Emory University around the turn of the millennium. So I knew there was more in there to mine. And there is. I mean, there are a lot of unpublished Ted Hughes poems about Sylvia Plath in Ted Hughes's archive that are sort of like the birthday letters poems, but not quite as polished, I suppose. There are lots of drafts. But yeah, I mean, it's just, there's a lot there. And then, of course, right at the end, when I was almost finished with the book, this treasure trove emerged. This woman named Harriet Rosenstein had started a Plath biography in the 1970s. And she was an amazing researcher. Like she tracked down so many people who had known Sylvia Plath. And remember, this is only a few years after Plath's death. So their memories were really fresh. And she interviewed them all. And so she transcribed the interviews, but she never finished the book. And so she just was sitting on this gold mine of information for 50 years. And then she sold her archive to Emory University. And in the nick of time, Emory allowed the public to see what was in this archive. So I was the first person who was able to look through it and publish some of what was in there. And
she was born in 1932. My mom who just died was born in 22. So there's still people around. And actually, when you started this years ago, they'd be in their late 70s, early 80s. Still, they're in their 80s. So you did get a chance, I assume, to talk to some of them.
Oh yeah, I interviewed about 50 people. Yeah, there were quite a few around, and even a psychiatrist who had shared an office with Ruth Boischer. And he was able to give me more context about what the psychiatric world was like in Boston in 1953 and, you know, just give me a sense of historical context. I went to McLean and got a tour of McLean, and I was able to, you know, do research in their archives as well, just on the sort of like not patient papers, right? But their methods, and look through all their old newsletters. And so, yeah, because I think Plath was not well served by mid-century psychiatry. I think that's pretty clear from my book. But even though there were good intentions along the way, but yeah, you know, one of the things you always wonder is if she had lived into the era of antidepressants and things like that, could she have been helped?
So, or her psychiatrist didn't say, hey, stay over there, don't come back.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of things that sort of happened along the way. And she was so afraid of electroshock therapy, of having to go through that again.
Well, she said she would rather kill herself than go through it again. And then also, so I wondered then if she felt that way about the whole science, if it is, of psychiatry, why she still hung on.
Yeah.
Why did she? Why did she continue to utilize it as a source of an attempt to get her back on keel?
I think she was really, she was very close to her psychiatrist, Ruth Boischer. And Ruth Boischer is someone that she met at McLean right after her first suicide attempt when she was 19. And Plath had been seen by a bunch of male psychiatrists who she just felt like were completely dismissive of her symptoms and were horrible. And the first round of electroshock therapy she had was without anesthetic, and she felt like she was being electrocuted. She was completely traumatized by that. So when she met Ruth Boischer at McLean, Ruth Boischer was, so she almost looked to her as a role model, because she was an intellectual woman who had children and had, you know, had a career and children. And I think Plath did get better at McLean under Boischer. And, you know, she had electroshock therapy again, which she wasn't happy about, but it seemed to work. And so I think when the depression hit again in 1962, 1963, she was still clinging on to this idea that Ruth Boischer could help her again, because she'd helped her once already. And yeah, so, and she was also enthralled to Freudian ideas. She was just very interested in Freud and Jung and all of that.
Yeah, there was a certain aspect of self-diagnosis, a journey on self-diagnosis, right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I think even Dostoevsky, she wrote her college thesis on Dostoevsky and this idea of the double. And I think for her, she, part of her depression was the sense of this really nasty critical voice inside saying, you're not good enough, you know, you need to do X, Y, and Z to get the world's approval. And I think that idea of a double fascinated her. And she saw that in Dostoevsky. And in a lot of her writing, there's a double figure.
Yeah. I've always had that kind of voice in my head. You know, you're not good enough, you're posing in your position, yeah. Dressed in the emperor's clothes. Yeah, and it's interesting because I've also had the ability to observe that, you know, which is almost like a triple. And that's helped a lot too. But yeah, explain a little bit more in her poetry if it is represented. Is that double, the second person, the commentator on your own life in her poetry?
Yeah, well, I guess a poem that comes immediately to mind is, it's called In Plaster. And it's this very witty poem. And the speaker is this woman who is in a full body plaster cast. And she talks about the cast on the outside as this saintly, perfect sort of embodiment of her, and the one in the person inside of the cast is nasty and dirty and and sort of selfish, and it's this interesting, you can really read it through a feminist lens if you want, where it seems to be about, you know, putting forth, it doesn't have to be feminist, but just the mask that you put forth in the world, you know, that you show to other people. And in the poem, it's the sort of struggle between the saintly outer self and the kind of more authentic, but a little bit more selfish and nasty inner self. And then I think the poem ends where the inner self is saying, like one day I'll be victorious, you know, one day I'll manage without her. So
yeah, and the thing about women is that it's not the other, the double, it's the world of men that put the mask on you, whether you like it or not, you know?
Yeah.
You are masked by them, and it's really hard, almost.
Yeah. And I tried to sort of get that historical context across in the book, just about the war, you know, the patriarchal world that she's living in America in the 1950s. And I quote in the prologue Adlai Stevenson's commencement speech at Smith College in 1955. Adlai Stevenson was Democratic presidential candidate. He was a liberal. And yet he told all of these Smith College graduates that they were destined to become humble housewives and that they, you know, you used to write poetry, now it's the laundry list. And like, you read this speech and you just cannot believe it, you know, that everyone stood up and clapped for that.
Yeah, I got mad at you then, because Adlai Stevenson has always been one of my heroes.
Yeah, I know. And he was Plath's hero too. I mean, she loved him. She loved Adlai Stevenson. And so, and because he was like the intellectual candidate, you know?
The egghead.
But, yeah, he was the egghead, exactly. So it's sort of shocking. It shocked me anyway to read that. And then, you know, she applied for a Woodrow Wilson fellowship to go off to, was it Harvard? I can't remember if it was Radcliffe or, but anyway, it was for graduate school, and the interview was at Harvard, and she faced this wall of male academics. And remember, she's coming from a very nurturing women's college where she's the star student, she's the pet, she has all these female professors who love her. And she was not ready for this. And she said all of the male professors just kept asking her, well, why should we give you this fellowship? Because you're just going to go off and have babies. And she was so mad about that because she had never really encountered it at Smith, like that sexism. And she just, yeah, she was really shocked.
Yeah, it's funny because when you read or when you hear kids or especially girls, 14, 15, 16, talking about her sometimes, they act as if she was not seminal, that she was behind her times, because now they see the way things are now.
Yeah.
And they go, why was she so? But actually, she was more ahead. Some of the things that we feel were seminal are derivative of her to a certain extent.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And I think of when I think of her kind of feminism, I think of her unwillingness to choose between a family and a literary career. Because back then, women sort of, that was the unwritten rule. Either you could have this literary life, you could be like Marianne Moore and Elizabeth Bishop, but you couldn't have the children, you know, you couldn't have the husband. You kind of had to choose. And she just said, no, I'm going to have it all. I'm going to have the family and I'm going to have the literary career. And that was quite daring at the time. That was a bit of a rebellion. So that's, for me, that's part of, yeah, her, what she bequeathed.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, still going on about Ted, but you feel like had he been there, had he not had the affair, had they continued to have a good marriage and been good parents and all that, then things would have changed. But so what? In my life too, there's so many pivot points.
Oh yeah.
It's like that movie Sliding Doors. I mean,
your
life kind of decides you. You don't decide your life.
And yeah. I mean, what if she had gone to Radcliffe instead of Cambridge, right? Yeah. So many little decisions that we make along the way. And writing a biography definitely makes you think about that.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, I never really thought about that, but that's true because you're able to see in retrospect where something pivoted.
Yeah.
And why a direct, you know, it's like a compass or a vector or something like that. And because, you know, if you're on a train and the other person is on the train or if he's on the landing and you see him for a second and then you either do meet him or you don't meet him. And that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I often think that she had a boyfriend before Ted Hughes who was called Richard Sassoon, and he was a French major at Yale, and she kind of, he almost reminded her of like a Baudelaire figure, you know, sort of decadent Rimbaud figure. But anyway, she wanted to visit him during her spring break at Cambridge, and he left Paris. She was going to Paris to see him, and he kind of ditched her. And I always wonder, like, if he had just stayed in Paris and they had gotten together, I think a lot would have been different. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting with poems because I think poems reflect that, because not that I always understand them, and not as cliche-ish as a poem should not mean but be, but still it's true. And you can read it and go, well, what the hell was that about? But it still makes you feel a certain way. And I think that reflects what we've just been talking about pivotal points in your life. And what I was saying about this telegramming out your life also, it's like the poems do, especially, and I'm not, no, she's not narcissistic, but when you're writing about your life or about things associated with your life or an allegory like bell jar, if that's what it is, you know, you are sending out signals to the world, not necessarily about yourself, but as a portent or as an example of what could happen to you as well. She was good at that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think she was so, I think she's such an important literary model, especially for women poets who came after, and women in general, but just like she wrote about a lot of things that really had not been written about up until then, like miscarriage, you know, and postpartum depression and And even her poems of motherhood. I mean, Anne Stevenson called Plath the first great poet of childbirth in the English language. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I just thought that was a really interesting thing to call her. And I think there is some truth to that. You know, she wrote quite a bit about experiences that like half the human race has, but that hadn't really made their way onto the page. So I really credit her with opening that up as
well. And it's good being a poet. It's good being a poet too, because the people who would normally censor you don't understand what you've written. So right. It's not like you're using curse words or talking about sex or something like that. Yeah. They don't understand, why is this something that I might be worried about?
Yeah. Okay. And well, I mean, I think, you know, when she sent out all of those late poems to the New Yorker and they just got rejected, especially by the New Yorker, I think some of those poems were just too shocking, right? For a magazine that was going to be on living room coffee tables. Poems like Lady Lazarus and the Nazi imagery. And oh my God, I mean, it was just like, it was a lot.
I have a book in my bookstore that's called Rejected. And all it is cartoons that were rejected by the New Yorker. And they're all hilarious, but they're just, they wouldn't put them in because it was just, no, we can't put them in, but they're all really, really funny.
Yeah. Well, it's funny reading the rejection letters from the American publishers about the Bell Jar. You know, they just, you read these letters. Oh, well, the heroine's struggles weren't really believable. And, you know, the Bell Jar went on to become this literary classic. So.
And then I guess kind of like to wrap this up, it's such a shame that all of this work, or the vast majority of the work, is just like with Van Gogh. She never saw
I know. Happened. That, that was one of the things writing this book that just made me so upset, because she really cared about literary recognition. And, you know, she was upset when she didn't win these prizes that she thought she deserved. And I think if she had lived to see, I think it would have helped her mental health as well, because publication always gave her a really strong boost and confidence in herself. And I don't necessarily think that it's just a coincidence that she died by suicide shortly after getting rejection letters from American publishers about the Bell Jar. I mean, obviously, I don't think that's why she did it, but it didn't help. Let's just put it that way. It didn't help, because she saw American publishers as sort of, I guess, more prestigious in a way than her British publisher. So that was a real blow, right? Getting a rejection letter for the Bell Jar in America.
Yeah, the other thing is that whether you're talking about Kurt Cobain or Ernest Hemingway, you don't know what would have happened afterwards, especially if she had achieved that recognition, what she would have gone on to do. And I'm sure that's something you wonder about a lot in your career.
Yeah, of course. I know she would have written more novels. I think we would have had a few more novels, absolutely. More brilliant poetry. Maybe her style would have changed again.
Well, okay, let's end with that. And I want to thank you for bringing to light, you know, a lot that was hidden in darkness, so to speak, and taking the enormous time, 1,000 pages to, like I said at the outset, portray the life of someone that you clearly love and know after her death as much as pretty much everyone who knew her during her life. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure. I'll talk to you soon, hopefully.
Yeah.
I'll see you.
Okay. Bye-bye. All right, bye.